This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Doe Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Piran Mumford asked, I've been south of the equator recently and I noticed that meteors seem to move more slowly there than when viewed from the UK. In the countryside, I see shooting stars which move incredibly quickly, but down near the equator, I saw falling stars which seemed to move much more slowly as they came down towards the horizon. Why is this? Is it the difference in viewing angle? Darker skies or something else?
Yeah, so that's quite a difficult question actually to answer because many factors may play a role. So I will try to go a little bit through the different factors I could think of, although I'm not a specialist of meteors in general. So meteors are small bodies, usually rocky or metallic in composition, and they become visible as they are very strongly heated during their entering the Earth atmosphere. In most cases, this heating results in their vaporization. And, well, what we can say is that the spatial distribution of meteorites is quite isotropic in our corner and of the solar system, and therefore the probability of a meteor like falling above the UK or above the equator should be the same. Meteors are equally occurring during the day as they do during the night. The only difference is that we actually don't see them because we are dazzled by sunlight. Well, if one becomes visible, then it might mean that it is actually quite big and it might hit the ground at some point. So then, like, yeah, visible ones during the day are not necessarily good news, but obviously it is very rare. Then what we can say is that meteors seen near the equator are not different on average than those that are seen anywhere else in the world. But of course, like, there might be particular occurrences that differ. So you may see like two very different meteors, one time in the UK and then another time near the equator. But if you observe many in both places, they should on average be the same. Okay, so then let's see like what's the trajectory and therefore like the speed that we can observe, because it's the question that's being asked of a meteor as it enters the atmosphere. So the meteor is coming from space at a large velocity, tens of kilometers per second typically, and its trajectory in the atmosphere will essentially depend on its initial velocity and impact angle on the atmosphere, but also on its size and composition. Its velocity in particular is at first very little affected by the atmospheric drag, but then suddenly decreases very sharply after a small time that depends on its initial size and velocity, but it can be up to a few seconds where it's almost not affected. So in fact, if you look at the equations for the atmospheric drag, so the force of the resistance of the air on the meteor, you see that the trajectory of the meteor to some extent is very akin to a badminton shuttlecock. So first, it goes very fast when you hit it, but then it might just end up to pathetically flutter onto your opponent on the other side of the net because it suddenly slows down. So that's kind of what happens with meteors. So thus, that means that whether you see a meteor as it just entered the atmosphere or maybe perhaps a few seconds later may result in observing very different apparent velocities. So the last factor here is whether you see the meteor or not, as it is not necessarily visible all its way. So if it is a small meteor with a soft composition, it will disintegrate very quickly and you will not have time to see it slow down. In fact, it will probably very quickly disappear and you will see it as a shooting star, essentially. On the contrary, if a meteor is large enough and hard enough, it will not disintegrate and it will slow down to the point that it is not heated anymore and becomes invisible, ending its trajectory down to the ground in a so-called dark fall. So in this case, it might actually be one of those that the listener saw near the equator, like one that eventually falls very slowly when it reaches a low altitude. Well, besides, it's obvious in this case that a darker sky would allow to see the meteor as it is less hot and therefore slower. So it could then explain partly what the listener saw. One last thing is that the listener gives an interesting precision in his question. The meteor near the equator that is described in the question was above the horizon, which means that the meteor was likely far away from the observer and perhaps with a grazing angle with respect to the observer. So actually, this alone could explain that it looked very slow.
And Daniel Seyfori asked, if a photon of light has no mass, hence it can travel at the speed of light, why is it attracted to a black hole?
Well, this is indeed a very puzzling question. So I would slightly generalize it first and say, why is light attracted or bent by gravity? And there are different ways of answering this question. So I will start by saying that the concept of attraction is essentially Newtonian. And it means that gravity is seen as a force that would act upon the trajectory of a given body. And in this case, we would consider a photon, a grain of light, if you will. In that picture, bodies with a mass produce the gravitational force, so for example the Earth, a black hole, you or me, basically. Under this force, the body accelerates in a very particular way. So I will take the example of the feather and hammer experiment that was performed by astronaut Dave Scott during the Apollo 15 mission on the moon. He released simultaneously a feather and a hammer, and they fell exactly with the same acceleration and hit the ground exactly simultaneously. So that's the effect of gravity. So why is that? Well, it's because the gravitational mass of the hammer, to which is proportional the gravitational force that acts upon it, is exactly equal to its inertial mass, which is the mass that makes a massive object harder to put into motion than a lighter one. And that's the same thing for the feather. The two masses are, this is called the principle of equivalence. And this principle stipulates that gravitational and inertial masses are equal, which results in all bodies falling exactly in the same way, independently of their mass or composition. So once we've said that, the question actually becomes the opposite. Why light would be any different than any other object of any mass? Well, of course, it is intuitively difficult to imagine. With a gravitational mass of zero, one would naturally think that there is no attraction at all, and independently of the fact that there is no inertia. However, if one assumes that it is possible that somehow there is a gravitational effect on the light, you can write the maths and show that the trajectory of any object in a gravitational field is rigorously independent of its mass, and therefore, it doesn't depend if the mass is zero or not, and light can be bent or attracted by a mass, even considering the 300-year-old Newtonian gravity. And actually, this light bending effect was considered long before Einstein. Well, what Einstein did, however, is, with his general theory of relativity, to resolve the conundrum between the attraction and the absence of mass by changing totally of paradigm. So in the Einstein world, basically, there is no gravitational attraction. Such thing doesn't exist. Gravity, in general relativity, is a field generated by any form of energy, which can be a mass through the relation E equals mc squared, but which can also be light, which carries energy, and this field curves space-time. Then, particles follow geodesics of this space-time, geodesics which are exactly the same independently of one's mass or energy. The principle of equivalence is plainly respected in that case. So by analogy, Earth's surface is a curved two-dimensional space. In this space, the shortest path from Manchester to Chicago, say, goes above Greenland. And this is the geodesic between Manchester and Chicago. If the Earth was flat, it would be a straight line and it would not go above Greenland. The other difference with Newtonian gravity is that the magnitude of a deviation of light in particular is exactly twice as large as what you would expect with Newtonian gravity. And this was proven initially by Sir Arthur Eddington in 1919 by observing the deviation of light during a solar eclipse. So, eventually, how does light fall into a black hole? Well, by definition, the escape velocity of the event horizon of a black hole is the velocity of light. This essentially means that unless a photon is emitted on a trajectory that crosses the event horizon, it will be deviated but not fall on it. It is even possible that light would orbit around a black hole, actually. Generally, a black hole should not be seen as something that swallows everything around. It is very much like any other star or planet, actually. Deviating objects that are too fast to be captured, orbiting with others slightly slower, and occasionally being hit by objects that are too slow to remain into orbit. The only difference is that it is more compact than other objects, to the point that even light does not escape once it has passed the event horizon.
I see, Dave is next. Typically, when we see an illustration of a binary system, such as a white dwarf and larger companion star, we see matter being drawn from the companion star in a tightly constrained tube. I can't see how the physics of this would work to maintain stable structure, as it is commonly depicted.
Yes, so these illustrations indeed deserve a bit more explanation. So usually what one would see is a compact object such as a white dwarf, which is actually not so compact, but let's say that's the beginning of what you may call compact, a neutron star, a black hole, orbiting with a normal star, either a main sequence star or a red giant. The latter is a big ball of plasma that is hundreds to tens of thousands of times larger than the compact object. The plasma is attracted by the gravitational forces of the star itself, which means that it remains as a ball of plasma, but also by the compact object that is orbiting with it. This results in tides, very much like ocean tides on Earth, where water is being attracted by the moon, except that it can go to extremes where the attraction of both stars is equally important. So this happens in particular at a point located in between the two stars called the Lagrange L1 point, named after the French astronomer of the 19th century. A particle dropped at this particular point in space between the two stars would float in weightlessness, going neither towards the compact object nor towards the star. However, this point is unstable, meaning that the slightest shift from it results in the particle falling on one side or the other. In fact, this point is very much like a mountain pass, the easiest point to cross from one valley to the other, or in this case, from one star to the other. The valleys on each side are called the Roche lobes of each star, after the name of another 19th century French mathematician. These Roche lobes are the volumes around the stars where matter at rest in the rotating frame of the orbit is gravitationally bound to the star on which side it is. The compact object is much smaller than the Roche lobe. However, the normal star is not necessarily so. This is particularly true when, in closed binaries, the normal star inflates at the end of its life and it becomes a red giant. Our own sun will become 200 times larger than it is currently when it becomes a red giant. So, when this happens, the star can eventually fill its Roche lobe until its surface reaches the Lagrange L1 point, and plasma starts to flow through that pass into the compact object Roche lobe. This is very much like a valley filled with water that flows out to the next valley through the lowest pass between the two valleys. This passage is very narrow, and the flow can be calculated based on the equations of the gravitational field and plasma dynamics, and depend on various parameters. But generally speaking, the representations that we often see of a narrow tube between the two Roche lobes through which most of the plasma is flowing, actually overflowing the star's Roche lobe, is actually quite accurate.